Right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, everybody. A little rousing good morning here. There, that's better. This really proves to be a little bit challenging since Nancy and I are operating by looking at the same research data set, the same 40, 45 oral histories, but we did this independently. So talk about inter-rater reliability. There may have been inter-rater reliability around the coding, but we are essentially trying to come up with very similar approaches and themes to the same kind of data, with each of us taking a slightly different tack. So we'll see how well this works. So what I'm going to talk about is really some of the organizational and cultural dynamics that occurred within both Mississippi and Louisiana, looking at specifically how they had organized themselves, how they staffed themselves, and then how it played out. I have no relationships to disclose that are financial in nature. Okay. So beginning with the context for some of the organizational shifts that have occurred, and I sort of want to put it into, you know, as did the previous presenters, the larger context. So clearly, you've got a $5 billion investment in public health that has occurred. It's actually closer to $7 billion in some ways, if you count many other aspects like the city's readiness initiative, since 9/11. This has been happening mostly through the streams of CDC and HRSA grants going to the state health departments and then either funneled out to the hospitals or to local health units and local health departments. At the same time that this has been occurring, much of the rest of public health financing has either remained stable or has declined, so that you've got a real tension that's going on within the public health departments themselves. You have structural elements in that there are various presidential directives and policy mandates and funding mandates that really shape the kind of organization that public health is required to do. You have a history, and this is actually the shorter history. I mean, you could do the longer history from the 1920s and 30s, but let's just look at the shorter histories leading up through the 80s, where public health was really involved in a lot of direct care and direct service, running clinics, but not necessarily doing that well. They were running clinics for poor people for the most part. The 1989 IOM Future of Public Health report comes out, really describes a public health system in disarray and failing, and changes the nature and says that public health should be more involved in oversight and regulation and assurance and get out of the direct care and provision for poorer people. And at the same time, you had managed care coming in, which was beginning to take away a lot of that direct care anyway and provide different incentives. So public health moved out of the direct care for populations, and this has obvious significance for what we're going to be talking about shortly. And then you have the events, obviously, that drive this, and you've heard, you know, anthrax, 9/11 drove a lot of the initial cultural shifts, and then Katrina, as we're about to describe, also force shifts to occur within an organization. So I took a look at some data from the National Association of City and County Health Officials from their national profile in 2005, where they surveyed 2,000-plus health departments, local health departments. And this is just to kind of get a sense of what happens when you throw and push a lot of money into a public health department. So if you look at the leftmost column, and that's sort of categorically splits out those health departments where bioterrorism or emergency preparedness funding, how it represented a portion of their budgets. So the larger the portion of their budgets, essentially what you see going all the way across, the more people they push in as full-time equivalents who are hired with bioterrorism funding that are really specific to emergency preparedness. That kind of makes sense, but it begins to push the organization, to shift the organization. This is the sausage making, where you're pushing $5 billion into a public health system, and you're seeing how these public health agencies are beginning to respond to it and try and hire up, deal with the mandates, shift the way they do things, and reorganize themselves. I mentioned before some of the structural issues. These are the policy instruments that are really shaping how public health is beginning to respond to this. You've got a national response plan, now called the National Response Framework, that lists very specifically a number of emergency support functions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. And emergency support function 8 is the Public Health and Medical Services Annex, and it really defines, at first it defines what the federal government is intending to do from a public health perspective, but then all of the states tend to align themselves with that public, that federal policy instrument. You have a National Incident Management System, the NIMS. You have Incident Command Structure, which is how to operationalize this huge response framework. You've got various policies and legislation that have come out and presidential directives. And then lastly, you have the Stafford Act, which is really what governs how FEMA will respond, and how FEMA and other elements of the government, the federal government, respond has a huge impact on how the states are going to in turn respond. So ESF 8, broadly, the purpose is to identify and meet public health medical needs of victims in an incident of national significance. The core functions, when you look at it broadly, it sounds a lot like the essential functions of public health. You assess, you surveil, you're in charge of healthcare personnel, medical equipment and supplies. But when you get down into the nitty-gritty details, and I don't expect people to look at all of these, but you get down to the nitty-gritty details, it's no longer about assuring. It's no longer about regulating and oversight. It's about delivering, providing. The active verbs now become much different. All of a sudden, public health, without it really being aware of it, is now in the position of going back to your providing, because as you'll hear from, as you've already heard from Nancy's description and what you'll hear from some of the similar quotes, that's what happened to public health when they tried to assure but nobody was there. They ended up having to provide. This is just a standard org chart for NIMS. It's not really important. So this brings me to a critique that had been presented in 1993 by one of the deans of disaster research, a fellow named Russell Dines, who's a sociologist at the University of Delaware. And he, I thought, has really encapsulated the two different ways to think about things. One of them is what he called the military model, and the other is what he called the problem-solving model. And he said these are some of the assumptions that go into these two models. In the military model, it assumes that there's social chaos, reduced capacity of individuals to cope during an emergency. You have to create artificial social structures for people. It distrusts individuals and those existing structures to make intelligent decisions. It places authority in a top-down structure, and it creates a closed system to overcome all of these weaknesses that have been perceived in standard conventional civil society. That is the military model, and it is, in fact, what really drives, clearly it drives military, literally military response, and what makes it often so very efficient. But on the other hand, he said, that's not necessarily what you need, and his critique is, you need to really look at a problem-solving model, which is, the emergency creates confusion and disorganization, but not chaos. It does not reduce the coping abilities or capacities of individuals or those social structures. The existing social structures are better than the artificial ones you can create. Individuals can make rational decisions. You'd rather have a decentralized and pluralistic decision-making structure that will value autonomy, that allows people at the most local level to really have the capacity and ability to think on their feet and innovate. And it should be an open rather than a closed system. So now it brings us right up to Katrina with Louisiana and Mississippi, and there are clear similarities between the two states. Number one, they both have centralized public health systems where the states really run the show for the most part in both states, with a regional and district structure as opposed to local health departments. Unfortunately, both are generally poor states economically with significant public health deficits in terms of population health insurance and disability. They often vie or have in the past for numbers 49 and 50 on, you know, the list of how they fare on a lot of public health measures. And there are interesting polarities between upstate, downstate. Different polarities in both states, but dynamics nonetheless. In Louisiana, you know, there's a somewhat of a resistance between Baton Rouge and New Orleans with what, you know, New Orleans is sort of the fun-loving city and Baton Rouge kind of the conservative city. I don't know if that's the fair way of encapsulating that. And similarly in Mississippi, the Gulf Coast in some ways is considered somewhat privileged, a little bit different, doesn't really fit into the same culture as the northern part of the state, both of which have their capitals in the northern parts of the state. There are clear differences between the states. There were great, enormous differences in terms of the gubernatorial experience, their political capital, and their governance style. And I would remind people that don't know this that the governor of Mississippi, Haley Barbour, was the former chair of the Republican National Committee, and so had an incredible amount of really dense and close relationships with federal officials in a Republican administration. The Louisiana governor was a Democrat, first-term governor, did not really have a lot of that political capital built up, and was really in more of a fight between her own state legislature, much less the federal government. There was clearly a much greater impact in Louisiana than in Mississippi in terms of the event itself, and it also was an incredibly significant hit to their largest city. And there were also varieties within each state's public health response plans, so that, as it happens, Louisiana does happen to put a lot more effort or emphasis on the special needs shelters that Nancy described before. When you look at their organizational structures, it really gets to be very interesting. And I've kind of boiled it down, and I told Aaron, don't take issue with some of the details, because I've tried to make this a very general way of looking at this. But in each of these, there's a real difference. In Louisiana, the Secretary of Health has underneath, at this point it was a male, him, sort of a deputy who at the time was the Medicaid director, and then there's separately a state health officer who is designated as the incident commander, a physician. And within that office, again, that's reporting directly to the secretary, there's an emergency preparedness office. But then you go directly down to the Office of Public Health, where Aaron works, and there you have a lot of the response structure is centered in that with Aaron as the medical director, the chief nurse, the regional administrator, and these are all public health. They're either physicians or nurses or long-term administrators with social work or public health background. That's really key, and keep that in mind. When you look at Mississippi, the state health officer, they don't have the secretary of health. They have a single person as the state health officer who then similarly has somebody below him who's the head of health protection, one of the three large elements in the state. He's designated as the incident commander. Underneath him, he's got an Office of Public Health Preparedness and EMS. Underneath him, he's got an Office of Emergency Planning and Response, and they've got emergency response coordinators. None of them are physicians or nurses. Those are military, fire, police, EMS folks, all of them. They come from an entirely different world and structure. I should maybe add as a personal aside, I'm a former paramedic, so I actually really like that structure myself. But it's very, you know, also having trained in public health, these are very, very different worlds. And so from one of the incident commanders, and I'm sort of just going to read this, it's hard for you to read it. We spend time on training for disasters, and all along the way I keep telling people we would only do things which would help us through any event, but that it would also improve our ability to do things on a daily basis. So we put in epidemiologists in every region of the state so that if there were any outbreaks, you know, they'd be able to handle it. We put a medical director in public health in each region of the state. What I worked on is having a system of state health officers in each region that would literally be able to handle things on the local level and kick it up here, where we've spent years building a system at the regional level that somewhat looks like the system at the state level. We spent a lot of time training people, getting them ready for major events, and at the same time improving how they do their daily work. What we did over 3 years is that every administrator in public health in the regions, every medical director that we recruited, had to go through these leadership training courses. Part of the training course is how do you become a leader in your community. Here's Louisiana saying they're really taking this public health approach. Really take those public health folks, the physicians in particular, build their capacity, build their skills, teach them the leadership, the community liaison stuff. That's what he's strategizing is the approach to take. Now let's look at Mississippi. The same person at the same level has a very different approach to this. The emergency response coordinators was one of the programs that I started with the bioterrorism grant that I put in each public health district, and I didn't go hire public health people to be the emergency response coordinators. I went and I either got police officers, firefighters, paramedics, and an ex-military person, someone that was used to responding, and then trained them in public health instead of the other way around. When an emergency happens, we don't have a meeting to talk about it, we respond to it, and then we try to learn from that and make it better. Very different style. And this is the top of that food chain. Those were the two tops of those food chains in each state, and that's going to have an enormous difference in how those two states respond. So here's one of the Louisiana officials describing their incident command structure. We set it up in consensus with the incident command structure. When I read this, I almost think of like a George Carlin routine about comparing football and baseball, you know, where he talks about the different semantics of how people refer to things, you know, and In baseball, you go home, and in football, you have a defense. So there are different ways that you think about these things, and it's really sort of writ large here as well, that the way they even talk about it is in consensus and communication in Louisiana. You have operations, administration, a public health information officer. Usually you might stand it up for a week. We were in that structure for a month. Communication was a big problem. You had so many factions in the state that were trying to help. The National Guard, state police, U.S. Public Health Service, you got FEMA. You had all these entities that had their own jargon. And so you have them here and you have them talking to each other, but they're not really communicating because they're speaking jargon that the other doesn't understand. Now hear Mississippi speaking about this. We negotiated a large influx of federal response. The National Disaster Medical System, basically every asset they had, DMAT teams, VMAT teams, we had surgical units from the Air Guard, we had EMAC public hospitals, we had mobile primary care, a lot of stuff coming in from the federal government. And it wasn't that difficult for us. They were a great partner for our state, unlike what I've seen in Louisiana. And I don't know the reason why it did not work or did not work as efficiently in that state, but I can tell you why it worked well in our state. The reason is because we knew who to talk to that has these assets. We knew where the assets were. We knew what the capability was so they could be appropriately assigned. And the people in the management that came with them were friends of ours, were colleagues of ours. We were on a first-name basis with HHS Emergency Response, with NDMS from FEMA, the National Disaster Medical System. They were helpful and very professional. Their teams were tight. They accomplished their missions exactly as they were directed to. And Mississippi had a great experience, at least on the health and medical side with the federal response. We had no problems there. What a world of difference. Listening to just the way they term these things. I mean, you could argue, they had the scale and scope of what Mississippi had to deal with was far different than Louisiana, no question. But they both were dealing with an enormous event. Enormous. But they were treating it very differently. So the days before Katrina, when we go through a lot of these oral histories, you hear what you would expect to hear, a lot of ramping up, people settling their personal affairs, constant phone calls and communication as they begin to devise their plans and strategies, true across both states, opening shelters, deploying assets. This is from an incident commander at the Superdome, who, by the way, is EMS, professional, firefighter. He's in that world. But listen to him talk. He's kind of unusual because he actually understands public health and thinks about it more than most people. Probably one of the interesting parts on Saturday, and by the way, the hurricane hit Monday, so they're all ramping up Saturday, Sunday, and the hurricane hits Monday morning. Probably one of the interesting parts on Saturday was getting the wife out of here. Of course, she did her wifely thing and begged me not to stay because she knew what the worst-case scenario could be. She realized there could be some danger involved if we took a direct hit from Hurricane Katrina. One of the things I tell people, and something you're not usually ready to deal with, is that she begged me to go with her. We discussed it a minute, and she understood, but she felt that she had to do that. And I told her I would be safe, I'd do what I could, but that I needed to stay. And she understood and supported that. You don't realize sometimes you have to make a decision. I'm telling my family, no, I'm sending you on, and I'm staying here. You don't realize what it's like when you see your loved one leaving, and you're telling them goodbye. During Katrina, in Louisiana, they were dealing with, as you heard, the special needs shelters, particularly happening in the Superdome, which was turning into, the mother of all shelters, and an evolving event that was obviously the flood. And they were tending to their triage, the medical needs of the special needs. And just prior to landfall in the Superdome alone, they had already triaged 1,000 of the patients. And managed to move 500 of them out. 500 were still remaining behind. And as many of you know, there were an additional 30,000 people in the general shelter population right next to them. And this became very quickly, as many of you have obviously heard over days, a fairly tenuous or untenable situation to sustain over time. And in both states, during the event, they were dealing with the immediate needs of food, shelter, water, fuel, and waste. Personal waste, sewage. Even as the event was happening, they were dealing with all of these, very mundane issues of, I've got a generator, but I don't have the right hookup. I need fuel for the cars, and I need to get tankers down here. How do I get the fuel? In Mississippi, where they have some of the largest fuel refineries in the state, and the refinery went offline, that had been their plan. Go to that Chevron refinery in Pascagoula and get their fuel. That refinery went offline. It was done. It was out of commission. They didn't have access to fuel. All of a sudden, in the middle of the event, they're now having to get flatbeds going up north, trying to get the fuel, bring it down, so they actually had enough fuel to run their generators. So here's an incident commander at the Superdome. Later that night, Sunday, we received a military vehicle that came in with a pallet of supplies. It looked as though it had been gone through already. It wasn't a lot of supplies. We had no oxygen. We didn't have any AMBU bags. There were a lot of things we didn't have. But then we really didn't think we were going to be needing them at the time. Also that night, contrary to a lot of people's belief, we received 10 or 12 18-wheelers full of food and water from FEMA. So this is, you know, stocking up during the event or just prior to it getting set. In the days after landfall in Mississippi, you basically had, you know, they were doing what you would expect, assessing damage, establishing a forward operations center. They had to literally break in. They broke the locks on the WIC warehouse to use for emergency food needs, and they said, even though this was against sort of USDA-approved use of this, they said, you know, we don't care. We got to break it. We have people who need food. Forget the WIC program for now. The population needs food. They deployed the Strategic National Stockpile, and again, although I don't have the quote here, it was really fascinating to hear how Mississippi operates their Strategic National Stockpile, which is 12 sites around the country that the feds maintain very large supplies of medications and durable medical equipment, disposable medical equipment, et cetera, that can be pushed out to areas that need them in the event of a disaster. So Mississippi got online pretty early. They made their request. They actually got their SNS before Louisiana did, even though they both requested it at the same time. So maybe you can look back at the political capital question. And they got, I can't remember how many trucks. They may have gotten 20 to 25 trucks rolling in to Mississippi to stock their Strategic National Stockpile. They made a decision not to use public health workers to do that, but instead they contracted out to warehouse professionals. And he said somebody from CDC came down with the stockpile. He said they emptied the trucks in 29 minutes. 29 minutes. He said, CDC said, nobody's ever done it that fast. So they were completely sort of professionalized in the way they were running the response structure. They also, both states were having to handle and deploy surges of volunteers, establishing temporary health care sites, and in Mississippi they were deploying a lot of teams that were coming in from Florida, the Florida Health Department. Interesting, both Louisiana and Mississippi, they sit on different sides of the FEMA regions. So Mississippi sits on one region and Louisiana on another region. And the side that Mississippi sat on with Florida, Alabama, et cetera, they had a very tight regional coordination that happened to have worked very well for them. And so they were able to bring in a lot of the Florida Health Department folks in Alabama, but they mentioned Florida again and again to really come in and take over a lot of the functions that they needed to do. In Louisiana, they were doing all of that, plus they were handling the consequences of the levee breaks and the flooding. They were extending their response phase considerably because of that, and they were making a huge effort to transport and move, to coordinate and move over 50,000 people out of harm's way. And as Nancy said, it was the transportation that became so critical for Louisiana. So this is interesting. This is from one of the folks in Mississippi saying, now speaking about a colleague of his on the coast. He says, we had a physician on the Gulf Coast. It just goes to show that it's not always a completely unified and unitary system and that there are always going to be personality differences. We had a physician on the Gulf Coast who works for us, works for the public health department down there, stand up on CNN and give an interview on national TV about we're going to have plagues and pestilence of biblical proportions, and started requesting that everybody be vaccinated for typhus, tetanus, hep A and B, and I just refused to do it. I'm not ordering 180,000 doses of everything to sit. We don't have enough refrigeration capabilities and we don't have enough staff to get it out. Then Dick Cheney came to town and promised everybody could have a tetanus shot. So that ultimately, because Cheney came to town and made that promise, he was now in the position of having to do at least some of it, and they ended up giving out and providing 139,000 tetanus shots when they normally on an average year do 14,000. This district system itself is kind of strange. It vacillated between a physician running it, and now we have the non-physician public health administrator running it. The physician is an advisor, a medical advisor, but Mississippi statutes require that physicians be health officers in the counties and district, and they have certain powers, even though they may not be in anything but an advisory role. So here you still have a little bit of tension between the local health, the physician at the local level, who is taking more of a conventional public health approach to things, and the state emergency response structure that is pushing that in a very different direction. On the other side of things, you hear a Louisiana public health official saying, I had staff that was in the Superdome, and so I was trying to constantly talk with them in the Superdome and find out what was going on, because there's a group of us that kind of stay down here no matter what. And so my emergency response coordinator was there, and I was trying to get back to our command center, which we set up in the Superdome. This is the woman who's shuttling now back and forth between Baton Rouge and the Superdome. And so when we got back to, after we had gotten everybody off the buses and the ambulances and all that, then we had to go and clean the buses and the ambulances because the clients were in really bad condition. So we had to go in, and I had the guys clean the buses. I went to the command center in Baton Rouge to get a feel for what was going on, and we found out what was going on, and there were people that were on I-10 and Causeway, that kind of thing. So we started going out each evening, picking up those individuals that were I-10 and Causeway. The buses, and she goes on to describe the buses and says, these young men that she had recruited for the buses didn't get on board to do this, but now we became this rescue, this recovery kind of group that went back and forth, back and forth. And this is the woman that Nancy referred to, Avis Gray, who's a rather remarkable individual, who's a nurse by training, but one of the key regional administrators in Louisiana, who took it upon herself to rescue personally thousands of people, by creating a little fleet of buses that was not part of the conventional plan. She went way out of the planning system and innovated to the point where she created a little fleet by making promises to the bus drivers and their families, saying, I'll take care of you and I'm going to be your go-to person and I'm going to go with you. And she literally went back and forth helping them do this rescue, even while she's supposed to be operating as well as a response coordinator above them, which proves to be a challenge, if not impossible. So in terms of then reflecting on how these two systems ended up, we have really two different ways of looking at it. One is you have Louisiana and what I'm considering is a blended approach where they're really trying to use public health as the foundation and basis for the way they organize their emergency response. And then you have a specialist approach in Mississippi where they've taken a different tack and they've really used the emergency response structure, the first response structure, as the one to hang everything on. There was clear tension, as Nancy described, between those emergency support functions and the essential support functions, where people were often torn in both states with trying to do both at the same time, and they found it impossible to do both. The command structures that existed, that the ICS, the Incident Command, did provide direction and lots of opportunity to move things and coordinate and communicate, but it also presented a number of barriers for people. The details of the response overwhelmed even the most meticulous plans, and I think this gets to, you know, the Dwight Eisenhower quote too, where no matter how detailed you had your plan, it didn't make a difference. There was one further detail you could not have thought about that was going to break the plan. And then when response and recovery partners were defaulting or abandoning their missions, public health's safety net became the provider of last resort in both states. So that could include everything, as Nancy described, which were the unanticipated functions of public health. They didn't necessarily think they were going to have to do it. They thought they would have to assure it. Now they were providing it directly. This is a long quote. There are two last quotes, but bear with it. This is the feeding the dog quote from Mississippi. Our people became not only ESF8, but they were pulled into virtually every aspect of response simply because we had communication, because our field personnel are cross-trained in fire and law enforcement and emergency management and several other things. They're not public health people. They're emergency response people and support public health. So they'll be able to mold, if you will, to every environment they needed to be in. The problem is one that I call feeding the dog. Public health and medical, ESF8, provides for the health and safety and well-being of Americans. And the definition of emergency, the reason for emergency management, the reason for fire, law enforcement, EMS, is a subfunction of providing for the welfare of health and safety. It's not an emergency unless someone is due to get sick or hurt. Otherwise, it's not that big a deal. It's not an emergency. So naturally, if there's an event or incident that won't fit in one of the boxes, that's the one that catches it. And we have to be careful to stay on track with our mission as ESF8 and push back on some of these issues, or it's like feeding the dog. You feed it one time, it's going to come back every time after that. In some cases, we did declare public health hazards, depending on the incident. 2 million pounds of chicken on the ground is a public health hazard, but at the same time, they wanted public health people on the scene documenting and this and that, and we said, look, we can't be everywhere all the time. We'll declare it a hazard, and then you need to handle it. So we had some issues like that, just an example of feeding the dog. But here's another way of looking at it from a Louisiana public health official. I finally figured out over the summer why anything I did worked. And that was because I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how not to say no. which is different from figuring out how to say yes. It's different in that you don't know what you're going to do to get around saying no. You just have to get off the phone and figure it out. And then further on, as this official is speaking of decision making, says, I never had to do anything alone. There was always somebody on the other end of the phone. I never had to make decisions by myself, which is good, because you shouldn't be. You shouldn't feel like you're alone in the wilderness. And it brings us back to this, what I started with, which is there are these two ways of looking at it, very different. I don't think I have the answer to this yet, but I think it requires, you know, some way of both dealing with the organizational structure and dealing with how you're going to blend those two. Thank you.
Well, that was a round of applause for David, but please let's give another round of applause for all three of our speakers. You know, it's we're 3 years out now. We just had our anniversary of this event, this Katrina event, and of course that same weekend we had Hurricanes Gustav and Ike, and Gustav came up the middle of Louisiana and caused a lot of problems with our emergency, our public health emergency operations center, which lost power and didn't have a generator. So what did we learn from Katrina? No, we learned a lot, and we really did all of that. But I want to say, then I'll give you all a chance to not come to the microphone since there's not one, but to make your comments and ask your questions. So you see this range of perspectives, this very clinical, very personal health-oriented direct services, and then into kind of the population-based, how do we provide this service to an entire state or an entire coastline from our speakers today. And I think we can all fill in the gaps in between, although I'm not sure that the gap between personal health and public health is absolutely bridged, but I think we're getting better at that. I would say about Arturo's talk that what he glossed over with his slide on all the logistical, legal, and communication considerations when you're responding to an emergency is that the Children's Health Fund came down totally self-contained. Not only were their providers experienced in providing care off of these mobile health units, but they also planned ahead on where they were going to go. They planned ahead on who was coming and how they were taking care of themselves, where they were sleeping, where they were getting food and showers and everything else that we needed to provide for the people in Louisiana and I'm sure in Mississippi. For the people who were being evacuated, not for responders, and not to say anything about the volunteers who responded without that kind of organization, but just from my point of view as a public health official in Louisiana, working with groups that were so well prepared to take care of themselves made a huge difference over working with people who we had to find housing and food and showers for. We did those things. We found those things for people, but it took away from our time finding those things for the people being evacuated out of New Orleans. Then just to have the perspective that Nancy and David bring from their oral history project is so helpful to me because when you're in the middle of it, when you're responding as someone who's also affected by not only because your coworkers lost family members and housing and everything they own, but also because your own house had a tree in it or your house was also flooded, changes the way you look at a response. So I encourage all responders, all public health responders to a disaster to really think in advance, what are you going to do if you're responding and you don't know the status of your house and, God forbid, don't know the status of your loved ones. So please make those plans ahead for yourselves. And I'll close by saying thank you very, very much to the Children's Health Fund, to New York University, to Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health for allowing their responders to come down and not only help us through the disaster, but also to step back and take this perspective that allows us to see the human side, the very human side of responding. We all felt, I felt completely inadequate responding to this storm because our response fell so far short of where we would have wanted it to be. Now, I will say that I feel a little better after Gustav and Ike because that response did show that we had learned something. But to be allowed this very, very kind perspective that tells us, you know, not everything fell short, is really helpful to me in my own growth as a public health leader, as a disaster responder, but also as a human being. So thank you all for being here. Well, please ask questions, stay around to make your comments, and thank you again to these great speakers. Jan. Hi. Thank you, and that was Jan Kosofsky, who is the executive director for the Capital Area Human Services Authority, which provides all the mental health, addictive disorders, and services for citizens with developmental disabilities. And she served, her agency served as the hub for the care that was provided for people who were evacuated out of New Orleans and into the Baton Rouge area, which is about a 7-parish area in the middle of the state. And then she helped develop a mobile health unit response that was both for mental and physical health care with many other providers in the area. So we appreciate her work, too, during Katrina. Well, we all did it. Any other comments or questions? Yes.
Given that we had an N of two, Louisiana and Mississippi, I mean, I think it really does pay to begin to look at, you know, what the other states do across all of the states. California in particular is a very well-funded state in terms, it's the most well-funded state in terms of its response structure and the way it has managed to integrate both public health and the emergency management communities. So I think it does pay to look at, you know, other models. There are many models. And it's not entirely clear whether it pays to develop a specialist within a unit or it pays to have a separate structure completely. And, you know, I think we have 50 labs out there with all the states on how they structure themselves.
Anyone else? Yes.
I'd like to pose my question to Nancy. A lot of the comments that's a very interesting question. And I think it's one that is debated a lot in Mississippi and Louisiana. What is the right answer? Should we really be trying to turn public health nurses into acute care nurses? I know that there's been a lot of training as a result of Katrina to help people have a greater comfort level, because sometimes you're going to be the only one there and you'd rather know how to do something even if it isn't really in your comfort zone or not, versus partnering with people that are really experts in acute care. And I don't know that I can answer that. I think it's so much dependent on the local context and what the local health infrastructure is. There are times, and certainly that happened here, where there just weren't enough health people to go around no matter what. So public health was going to have to do some things that weren't in its comfort zone and they didn't really feel that they were trained or competent to do. But it's really, really tough. You know, if you think about it, if you go into public health and you have this population approach and it's preventive health largely these days, you know, besides the assurance function, it's largely health promotion and disease prevention, even increasingly more going towards population things like obesity. Is that the same person who's going to be really comfortable with dialysis patient or a tracheotomy? I don't know. I don't think I can answer that, and I think it really does depend on the local environment as to who is going to end up doing it. I know it's not a very good answer, but I think it's real. And I certainly talked to people all the way along the line that had very opposite perspectives on it. Some people said, no, we're going to train up, and other people said, we shouldn't even be getting into this business because it's really over our heads. So hope I answered your question.
Yes, Dr. Garrett.
Hey, a question Hi. For you, Dr. I think a really interesting comment or a really interesting aspect that came up in the discussion was the juxtaposition of the experience in Mississippi and Louisiana vis-a-vis the federal assets. And I thought it was really surprising because Mississippi has such a great experience with NDMS and FEMA, whereas Louisiana had a more obstructive experience with the feds. I think it's interesting that for things like ESF 8, it's usually the people at the highest level making decisions about health and public health that don't have any public health experience. And you saw that in Mississippi because you're really at that point it's about politics and not about ESF 8. And right. Your experience, your position very highly placed in state government. How can we influence that process so that we can convince the non-medical and health people who are responsible for making decisions to use assets such as us to do a better job?
Well, that's a good question. Well, what we did, I'm going to answer by saying what we did, and I think it is better. What we did after Katrina was to get together with local public health and medical people, state level, and federal people from the from NDMS, and we met just interminably, it seemed like, but I think it was probably three or four times, and we created this gigantic, you know, non-Dwight David Eisenhower plan, and it really spelled out, you know, what are we going to do at each level? What are the responsibilities and roles at each level of ESF 8? And I think that really did help. I mean, it at least allowed us to combine the three levels of jargon that had gotten in the way when we were responding to Katrina. I think there's still some details to iron out. The federal government created federal medical stations, which we thought were going to be somewhere in between our medical special needs shelters and hospitals, because that always became an issue during Katrina, and it did during Gustav and Ike as well. The hospitals couldn't admit someone because they didn't meet admission criteria, but they were too critically ill, acutely ill for our special needs shelters, which let's remind ourselves that these are staffed by public health nurses who give vaccinations and WIC vouchers out every day in their normal jobs. So now, not to say that we don't have help in those shelters, because we do. But then they didn't turn out to be that in-between. So we still need to work. They were really more, we were the in-between, and the federal medical stations were at the other end of the spectrum. And I think that was more about the reality that the people that the federal government brings in to staff federal medical stations are just like the people almost who provide public health services in Louisiana every day. They're U.S. Public Health Service people who are not any more comfortable taking care of critically ill patients than we are. So it becomes kind of a resource limitation more than anything else at that point, I think. Just to stop rambling and get back to your question, I think we really have to continue to communicate and continue to say, this is what we expect of ourselves, this is what you can expect from us, and what can we expect from you, and then how do we continue to bridge the gap and continue to pull people in from the hospitals. And just to go back to the previous commenter's question for Nancy, I think we really have to create a culture of preparedness in our communities, not just in public health and not just in the hospitals where we have drills in the emergency rooms when we're residents or medical students, but teach nurses and medical students and other responders from the get-go that, you know, you have a civic responsibility, and part of that civic responsibility is to help your community respond to a disaster, and teach them along the way how to do that, encourage people to join medical reserve corps. And I was in a session yesterday on war and public health, and they said, well, how do we change the culture around public health and our approach to war? And somebody said, well, start a Department of Peace in the federal government. And they also said, use the Peace Corps for real peace engagements, and allow people who are maybe not going to go to college or don't want to go now to go into the Peace Corps like they would go into the military to get future benefits, but allow them to do that through the Peace Corps. And so is there a way to allow clinicians to do that as young clinicians so we learn how to respond to emergencies? That's just one idea. So I'll stop now and let other people have something to say. Did that?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's my question. When are you
going to
run for office?
Oh, gosh. Never. I'm not a good politician. So, thank you all.
Thanks.
Great job.
Great.
Oh,
you did.
Very
nice to meet you.
Very
thanks
nice
so much.
To meet you as well.
It was.
Hi, Alan. I saw you.
Hey.
Hi.
Absolutely.
That was very nice of you to say that.
Great.
Yeah, nice. Thank you.
I came up in April.
Yeah. Sorry about that. They're actually nice, aren't they? They're not so bad. You can work out of them.
That's what Mayor Brew had.
Good. How are you doing?
Good.
Let me come around. Say hello.
Are you?
Yes. Oh, I'm going to show up Saturday at like 7.
Oh, okay. We used to have a joint MPH program with them.
I know. It's kind of hard to get out of
there. Oh, it's all the work out
there. Yeah, she went there when I was there. A long time ago, and I
went
on to get a
PhD.
Oh, wow. So are you from the East?
Yeah, I grew up in Maryland.
So how are you?
In New York City.
Uh-huh.
Really interesting.
But those are employed in large part.
Very nice to meet you. I look forward to reading it.
Region, actually. And we got there, and he's basically like, you got all five of them. We got there, and he's like, you know, you really need to get the red cross. Got struck and drove across the hill. He's got the top thing that I don't want to do. He drove us over the red cross. And 2 hours after there, we're meeting with like, the head of the wall. Sitting there with the red cross. By that afternoon, we were already in the place. I was until literally 48 hours we got out there. It's a very interesting relationship.
So you're the future of blending up sort of
50% homeless folks showing up at shelters for healthcare, food.
Hi.
I work for Children's Health Fund.
Oh, you do?
In Arizona, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Southeast Arizona.
Yeah, where initially people are asking
about
the water and the subject.
Yeah, yeah.
You've heard of the whole.
No, I work with, David works with Erwin Redliner, who both directs the National Center for Disaster Mailman, and the Children's Health Fund. I'm at NYU. Yeah, I was at Mailman when I started this. So it's Erwin Redliner who brings these two pieces together. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. I'm really glad that you enjoyed it.
All right.
It's good to have the experience in the health fund. So you're so yeah. I just moved
there a couple of years ago.
Lots of good people. And you ended up in Arizona through the Children's Health Fund, or were you living there? So how'd you get hooked up with Children's Health?
We go back. I used to think
Yeah.
But maybe that's not where to do politics. That'll be okay.
Great. So you're a pediatrician. It's terrific. It's great. It's a wonderful organization. It's fabulous. Nice to meet you as well.